Welcome to Sales for Nerds. I'm your host and chief nerd, Ruben Swartz. If you started a business because you love serving clients, but realized you didn't like the sales and marketing aspect of running that business so much, this is the podcast for you. Sales and marketing doesn't have to suck. It can actually be a lot of fun. And on this show, we're going to teach you how to connect instead of network, teach instead of market, help instead of sell, so you can keep serving people even while you're building your pipeline and growing your business. Now let's get to it. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Jonathan Stark. He is the host of the Ditching Hourly podcast. He's also the author of Hourly Billing is Nuts. And if you've spent any time listening to me talk about pricing, you know that I am in such complete alignment with Jonathan that I was actually shocked when I found him out there and wondered why I haven't known about him before and had him on the show. I've been listening to his podcast, and you absolutely need to hear what he has to say. Jonathan, welcome to Sales for Nerds. What do you have in your glass?
Well, thanks for having me. I've got, La Crema Pinot Noir.
That sounds delicious. I've got a Gravino Pinot Noir. Cheers. So cheers to that. Now, you are a former software guy like I am. So how did you end up with this mission to rid the world of hourly billing?
I literally had an epiphany. I was the VP of a small software firm. We had about 10, 15 employees at any given time, you know, basically all developers and one office manager. And I was like, one day I just realized that our best guy was our least profitable guy, and our most junior guy was the most profitable guy. And you just follow that logic out, and it's like, we should get a bunch of juniors that are slow and take, you know, just have to do things 2 and 3 times. But I just couldn't square that with my direct experience of work. You know, we had the junior guy was basically an intern, and our best guy was very sought after. He could have worked anywhere he wanted, but I was like, why? You know, he got paid twice as much as the junior guy, and the junior guy's clients were just as happy. He had a great bedside manner, and ultimately, after weeks, embarrassing to say it, but weeks of thinking about how I could square this circle, you know, like, no, our best guy's definitely our best guy. Like, we should definitely try and get more people like, and I say guys because they were all guys, but I was like, I don't know. I just couldn't figure it out. And then I was doing gymnastics, like, well, he trains the other people, so that's kind of unbillable, but it's valuable. But it was like, wait a second, then they get better and faster and we make less money. So it took me weeks, and then when it hit me like a ton of bricks. I thought, oh, the problem is we're billing hourly. And if we were giving fixed bids for projects, our best developer would be way more profitable. And then I just couldn't unsee it. I was already sick of thinking about hours nonstop all week. That was all I did. I'd build systems to track hours better. I'd chase the developers to get their hours in. I'd be fighting with clients about invoices that we sent out and how come this took 2 hours this week and only took an hour last week. And I'd be meeting with new clients and trying to get an hours estimate together to send them a proposal. And then ultimately it would always go over, and then they'd start complaining. Of course, they should start complaining. And so all of a sudden, when it hit me that was a business model choice that we never explicitly made, I just had to do something about it. And I explained it to the owner, and I said, look, we need to do something else. And he's like, I get what you're saying in theory, but how would we actually do it? And at that time, I had never heard of value-based pricing. I had no idea. I knew we needed to do some kind of fixed prices for projects because we just did project work. That was all we did. And I was like, I don't know, to be honest. So I'm gonna quit, and I'm gonna hang out my own shingle, go solo, and I'm gonna start from scratch with no hourly billing and see what happens. And it went great. Like, the first year my revenue was double my income from the firm, which is a little bit apples and oranges, but it is indicative of the kind of profitability you can get with fixed fees. If you're good and you know what you're doing, you're an expert, fixed fees are the way to go. It's like hourly billing punishes expertise. It's the opposite of reward.
So I have a bunch of questions from that story. One was, what was the niche that you hung your own shingle out in?
The firm I worked at was a very well-known FileMaker development firm. This was going back in 2003. I started there, and very well known. Perhaps the most best well known. Certainly one of the top three. And I got a job there. I worked my way up. I ended up the VP by 2005 or so. And I had become very well known too because the boss there, the owner Chris Moyer, was an extremely generous guy, and he was always inviting his employees to, try and get them gigs to write and speak and do all these things. So I had made a name for myself thanks to him, getting my name in. I was writing a monthly column for the physical FileMaker Developer magazine. It was an actual magazine back then. So I had a column in that. I became some kind of editor. I wasn't like the editor, but some kind of technical editor for the magazine. I was speaking at the conferences. So I was pretty well known, and I had a bunch of clients that I worked with directly. Maybe I think it was two or three clients that pretty much only I worked with at the firm. So when I left, we worked out a deal where we split, it was something like a 50-50 split, where I would continue to service those accounts and give Chris half the money. So I started off with a really easy, real soft landing. But yeah, from then on out, I mean, I did it. As I figured it out, I did a couple of little things where I'd bill for an hour here and there, but all of my big projects were fixed price, and it was amazing. It's just absolutely amazing what it does for your profitability, but more importantly, the quality of life, the relationship with the clients dramatically transforms into something beautiful and friendly. But yeah, so I'll stop there.
No, that's great. I think these are some of the themes that Alan Weiss was talking about back in episode 61, where if you have hourly billing, your incentives are at cross purposes with your client and with your own sort of professional development. Like you don't have you penalize yourself for making things more efficient, for automating, for outsourcing things that should really be outsourced to more junior people or even software tools or Fiverr or whatever it is. So,
Yeah, 100%.
totally agree. And I think for a lot of folks, they get stuck on the whole notion of, but that's the way I've always done it. That's the way my clients expect it. And I'm scared about being burned. Or some people, maybe they did a fixed price project once and it didn't go well. And so they're like, never again. So, how should people start thinking about this if they want to make the transition?
Sure. Well, first shout out, that Alan's book, Value-Based Fees, was my Bible for my first year in 2006. My copy of that book is like destroyed. It's full of notes, dog-eared. I would go back and read it every year for years after that and find something new that with, as my experience increased, I'd be like, oh, that's what he meant in chapter seven, you know? Yeah, so highly recommend that book for anybody who's thinking about doing this. It's absolutely genius. How do people think about making the transition? So let me jump on one particular point you made there, where people have tried fixed bids in the past and gotten burned, and I had too. And the problem there, the reason why that happens in general, at least in my experience, coaching, hundreds of people on this, is that when they give a fixed price, what they're really doing is a cost plus or time and materials fixed price. So it's kind of like they meet with the client maybe once, maybe twice, and they try and get an idea of the overall scope of the project. And when I say project, I mean things that are non-trivial, like 6 months to a year, maybe even longer. A big project, not like a little repair. So you get this big project, you sit with the client for maybe an hour or two unpaid in a sales interview, and the whole time you are desperately trying to get a sense of what the scope of work is, how long it's going to take you to do what they want. So they give you this list of features they want. You don't question any of it. You're just, you're maybe trying to go deeper a little bit on like, well, the invoices always only go to one client, or could you possibly have two clients on an invoice? You just ask them these like business model questions, data model questions for the kind of work I did. And at the end, we had literally had this formula that was like, okay, if there's going to be this many layouts and there are this many portals on each layout, and the business logic on a scale of 1 to 5 is like a set, 1 to 5, a seven, one to
Probably that's
seven.
an accurate Freudian slip there. On 1 to 5, it's a 7.
It's always a seven, not a five. So you basically, you definitely don't know the whole scope for sure. Like, there's no way.
They
Even
don't
if
even know
they,
the whole scope.
no one knows the whole scope. But you're sitting there, and you're going to base an estimate on the scope, And you tell yourself, well, it's only an estimate. You know, I mean, I think it'll take, you know, whatever. Let's just for round numbers say I charge $100 an hour and it's going to take 100 hours. So my estimate to you, to your client for this list of features that you asked for, it'd be $10,000, I think. You know, but they don't take it as an estimate. They're forced to make a purchase decision in that moment, and they have no choice but to treat it as a price. It doesn't matter if you have it in red flashing lights, this is an estimate, you can't hold me to this. It could go over by double or more, which is not uncommon. They treat it as a price, and they say, go ahead. You start working, you turn on the meter, you start working, you send them an invoice every week or 2 weeks or a month. And you know, you and when you're you realize when you're 90% through the budget that you got 90% to go. And they start to get real cranky, and they start to go over every invoice and timesheet with a fine-tooth comb. They start to micromanage you because you have demonstrated that you're either bad at estimating or controlling scope or both. And they feel like there is a hole in the bottom of their checking account where money is leaking out and there's no one in sight. So they try and start to, you know, backseat drive the project if they haven't already. And it becomes incredibly uncomfortable. There's a lot of, you know, hour-long meetings arguing over an hour. And you know, and then my favorite is when people are like, well, I'm gonna bill you for these meetings. And it's like take out the baseball bat and hit the client. Stop calling me, stop calling me.
I'm sure
So
no one listening has had any experiences like this, so
right. It's
they can use
like
their imaginations.
just imagine that someone has once experienced this sort of thing. So the problem is when they did that fixed price project, they did it based on their estimate. And they said, you know what? We're gonna put our money where our mouth is. We think it'll be 10,000 hours. Maybe they tack on 15% for project management and or margin or something. And so they say, okay, for you know 12,000, we'll do the project. And the scope creeps all over the place. And by the time all is said and done, if they had billed hourly, they would have done more like 24,000. So they feel like they got killed. The problem is they didn't ask any of the right questions in the sales interview to control the scope in the first place. They didn't ask any questions in the sales interview that would give any sense of what the client's underlying goals were, what those, you know, reaching those objectives, what those objectives might be worth to them, to find out if it even makes sense to do a project. So you've asked all the wrong questions. You've given yourself none of the tools to write a really good proposal. It's certainly not, you have absolutely no way to write a value-based proposal. And if they do start, you know, if they green light this fixed bid project, you have no way to control the scope because it's all about features. And you could build all these features and they'll be like, well, but it's not doing what we wanted. Well, what do you want it to do? Well, we want it to increase sales. Well, you didn't tell me that. Well, you never asked. So, or a productivity or morale or whatever the business metric is that they want to improve, it was never discussed. So you're shooting in the dark. I mean, it's like playing basketball with a blindfold on. Like the odds of getting a basket are slim to none. Your only hope is that the client in an hourly model, your only hope, or even at a fixed price based on time and materials, your only hope of satisfying the client is if the exact stuff that they asked for is actually going to give them the business outcome that they want. But if you're an expert and they're spending, you know, probably top dollar even by the hour to hire you, it almost by definition means they don't know what to ask for to achieve that outcome, or they would just do it themselves. So or hire an employee to do it, you know. So you're just driving blind, and it's no wonder, you know, you're just driving the cab around with the meter running, and they're like, you know, it starts to get expensive, and they say, no, I don't know, turn left, turn right, and you're like, is this where you want to go? No, maybe try a U-turn. How about now? Are we there yet? So it's just horrible. It's there. Anyway, I'm gonna soapbox like crazy because this is like my thing, but it's awful. This is an incredibly long answer to your question. The reason people get killed on fixed bids is because they based it on the scope and they were wrong about the scope instead of basing it on the value and doing the scope last. Figure out the scope after you have the value. Find the value, set a price, then you decide what scope of work you're going to commit to for that price. And you work backwards from the desired outcome and the value of the desired outcome to the client.
So you treat the actual disease instead of a list of symptoms.
Precisely.
It's like if you said, hey, I want a house. It should have 4 bedrooms and 3 bathrooms and a living room and a kitchen. How much does it cost? And somebody gave me a price. That price is never going to work because you need to know a lot more than that to actually estimate how much it takes to build a house.
You need to know up front what the success criteria is for the buyer if you want to satisfy the buyer. The buyer's going to want you to keep going until they're satisfied or they run out of money. So you want to find out before you even decide to take on the work, whether or not you are confident that you can satisfy the client. Some clients are unsatisfiable. It's true. Right. Like it's possible. They could want, a Facebook clone built over a weekend for $1,000. That's not a satisfiable person. And they want a billion
users by Monday.
Right. It's not satisfiable. So you just like run screaming. But if someone came to you and said, what's your hourly rate? Oh, it's $100 an hour. Could you build me a Facebook clone? Sure. How long do you think it'll take? I could probably get the basic features done in a week. Oh, so it would be like $4,000? Yeah, probably. All right, get started. And now they've got sunk cost. A week later, you're not even close. It doesn't do anything they want. It's not creating the network effect they want. It's just disaster. It's a disaster. You can start working and billing them before you even know where you're driving the cab. It's like them saying, just drive.
So I think hopefully people listening are nodding and saying, yep, I get it. And at the same time, we've sort of defined the situation where I think you raise a great point that you're the expert and you have to figure out what the real problem is and help them refine maybe what the problem is and the route to getting there.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's an independent engagement of its own.
That's exactly what I was asking, right? So that's the key, I think, instead of doing a bunch of free consulting, the first engagement might be the investigation or the scoping session, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, in general, I refer to this as a roadmap, but it takes different names depending on what kind of job you do. So it could be a blueprint. If you're an architect, it could be a blueprint and a series of other deliverables that are, that would go along with that, elevations and maybe 3D renderings and fly-throughs and all these other things. But it's like when you sit down with a prospect and you do a sales interview with them, I let them brain dump for like 15, 20 minutes till they get everything off their chest that they think they know about the project, all of the self-diagnoses, you get them on the table. I take tons of notes. I say, thanks for that. This is super helpful. I've already got 5 pages in notes. Can we back up so I can understand the business context that this project will release into? Because I want it to be a success. So I want to know like how you're going to measure the success, whether or not this is a home run. And good clients will lean back and say, yeah, let's talk about that. And clients that are going to be a bad fit will just be like, what do you need to know that for? Right. So the good clients will lean back and say, sure. And then you go into what Alan Weiss would call trying to get conceptual agreement. I just call it the why conversation, where you ask those 3 questions, like why this, why now, why me? And you use those as a framework to uncover the real success criteria. How are they going to know this was a home run? What would that home run be worth to this business? Like if we really hit a home run with this project, what would they sit back? Oh, that'd be so great. I wouldn't have to work weekends anymore. Or the team wouldn't have to work weekends anymore. Or employee morale would go through the roof, or our conversions on the mobile website would triple, and what would that do for revenue, right? So you get them thinking about, this thing is so obvious to them that they don't think to tell it to you. So you have to help them uncover it. And when you get to the end, you'll be able to place a value on that and come up with 3 prices and come up with scopes for each of those prices. But if you're talking to the real buyer, like the owner, and they can't answer enough of these questions for you to get there, that's when it's time for a roadmap engagement. And you'll have a ballparky feel for like the size and scope of a project if it's, by an order of magnitude. Like this is probably a $10,000 project or a $100,000 project, or could be a $1 million project, the implementation piece. So dear client, I'm asking you all these questions. You know you should know the answer to them, and you know you don't. We can't come up with these answers. What do you say? We do a preliminary engagement where I do whatever you need to do. It might be a diagnostic, it might be a design phase, it might be market research, focus groups, it could be a business model, it could be software architecture, it could be a million things. So you say, well, I do this thing, and it's about a tenth of what the build would cost. You know you're gonna spend $1 million on this, or you know you're gonna spend $100,000 on this for sure. The road mapping phase, or whatever you call it, it's $10,000, and what it's gonna do is reduce the uncertainty in the project. So at the end, you're going to have a very clear vision and of the objective. You're going to have a step-by-step plan with, possibly milestones, a Gantt chart, some kind of plan, some kind of planning document that is totally portable. You can take this to someone cheaper than me and get them to build it. This is the roadmap. You could have someone else drive you from New York to LA, but here's the map. Here's the path you should take based on the kind of experience you want to have. Here's where you should stop for gas. Here's where you should stay over. This is the scenic route, the one that you wanted. And you could have anybody drive you. I don't have to drive you. If you want me to drive you, I'll give you a price for that, but it'll be the most expensive of anyone. You could go get someone else to drive you, but I'll give you the map, the itinerary, the chart of where to go. And you know that you need to do that when the buyer, you're talking to the real buyer, not a gatekeeper, and they can't answer the why questions. They can't tell you why they're doing it. They're still running on gut instinct. That's too scary, too much risk. I can't be sure I'm going to satisfy them. I don't want to take their money unless they're going to be satisfied at the end. Like, my product is not software, it's customer satisfaction. So if I don't believe I can produce customer satisfaction, I'm not going to start. It's not worth it.
It's funny, you're saying these things, and my mind is going back to an incident a long time ago where somebody asked me to do something for them, and I suggested a road mapping session, and they balked at the price and said they didn't need that. They knew what they were doing. And I was working with the owner, right, who was a very sharp guy, very motivated. I really wanted to help. And I was like, okay. And then, like, 3, 6 months in, we realize, as smart as he is and as knowledgeable as he doesn't know certain factors about how his sales team operates. So all the stuff we were doing that I thought was great, like, I'm checking all the boxes, right? I'm doing what you asked. It's awesome. It's totally working, except it's not, because there's a whole set of scenarios that he wasn't aware of where none of this works.
Right.
And I'm like,
Yeah.
oh, we wasted so much time and money, and I feel crappy because I didn't solve your problem.
Yeah. You can build a house without a blueprint, but how do you think it's going to come out? Just start pounding nails. How hard could it be? I can build, I can, I build a doghouse. Why can't, how come I can't build a shed or an extension or redo my bathroom?
Right. Or skyscraper.
Yeah. I
Airport
know how to use a
terminal.
table saw, right? Yeah.
You're ahead of me on that one. So I think this makes a lot of sense. I, at least, of course, you're preaching to the choir here, so that's not a great test. But everything you're saying is really simple. Where I usually see people get tripped up is, okay, great, I get it. Now I've got to price my road mapping session, or I've done the road mapping and I know that, the bread box is this big. How do I price that? And how do I give the options for good, better, best, or the core and the add-on, or whatever?
Yeah.
How should people start coming up with actual numbers?
Okay, so if we assume that everyone listening is good at what they do, they're an expert of some kind, and they've felt the pinch of hourly where they're like, geez, I'm working harder than ever, I'm doing better work than ever, but I'm doing it so much faster that I'm making the same money I made last year and the year before and the year before. That's hourly billing the problem. It doesn't matter how fast you raise your hourly rate. I've never seen anybody raise their rates fast enough to actually grow their revenue faster than their expertise. So, all right, so there's three things you can do. You asked me about one of them, but the three things you can do is package your expertise as a product. You can package it up as a productized service, which is a hybrid between products and services. And you could package it up as just custom projects, which is what you asked about. So when they come to you and they say, we've got this sprawling thing. It's going to be, it's a project. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not ongoing staff aug. It's not retainer. It's a project. And at the end, there's going to be a launch. It's going to be done. So, okay, that's a project. And you go in, you have the why conversation. Or, whatever Alan calls it, value conversation or conceptual agreement. But you uncover the goal. If I can't uncover the goal, I'm going to offer them a roadmap or nothing. If I can uncover the goal, and it's an art, it's not a science. It's very psychological. You have to kind of be like a psychiatrist and like ask these open-ended questions to get them to kind of explore their underlying motivation. Because for them, a lot of it is gut instinct, often. And once you uncover their desired outcome, the way they're going to know that there was a home run, you can do a pretty easy back of the envelope calculation of what that might be worth to their business every year. Generally things like this accrue year over year. It's like a big improvement, whether it's productivity or increased brand reputation, whatever it is. So they want this success. They want this business outcome, this desired future state. And you're confident that you can do it based on what you've learned so far. You've written down all the stuff that they want you to do, the self-diagnosis that they want you to do to get there. But you're writing it down, but you're rejecting it, basically. You're like, you want to validate any of those steps. Sometimes they're good steps, sometimes they're not, but you just reject any scope that they give you. So you're like, okay, this for business this size and the nature of a project like this, it's definitely worth $100,000 a year to them of either incremental revenue or decreased stress from their employees, whatever. It might be dollar amount, it might be something a little more intangible, but it's worth something to the buyer. It's worth some amount of money. And you think to this buyer, this is going to be worth $100,000. They'd pay that again in a heartbeat. If I could wave a magic wand and make this success criteria happen, they'd gladly write me a check for $100,000. It would totally be worth $100,000 to them. So would they give me $10,000 to wave that magic wand? Heck yeah, all day long. Would they give me $22,000 to wave that magic wand? Yeah, almost for sure. Would they give me $50,000 to wave my magic wand to give them that 100 grand? Why wouldn't they? Right? Because it doubles their money, even at that high price point. So if you've determined roughly, again, art, not science, but you've reason to believe that the outcome that they want is something you can contribute to in a big way and is worth $100,000 to them, then step two, now I've determined a value. Step two is, I'm going to write a proposal with three options in it, small, medium, and large. And I'm going to, my rule of thumb is 10% of the value, 22% of the value, and 50% of the value. And what this does is it gives you three budgets to work with so that if you're wrong about the $100,000, even if you're off by a lot, one of these prices is still going to make sense to them, right? But obviously you can't do the same thing for $10,000 that you could do for 50. So what do you do? I would think to myself, okay, I know what the desired outcome is. I know what they think my contribution is going to be. Like, they're bringing me in as an expert in mobile user experience, or, you know, like, I know what category that they think that we're in. I believe that my category of expertise will contribute to this desired outcome. So what could I do using my expertise that I'd be happy to do for $5,000? Mm-hmm. And I come up with a scope that I would happily do for $5,000. And that's my $10,000 option. So I give myself tons of wiggle room on the scope so that when things change, which inevitably they do, they will, because you don't know everything. You don't know the scope. I mean, you're designing a scope, but still things are going to happen. And you just say, all right, my walk away price on this is $5,000. So it's a good thing to offer at the $10,000 tier. Do the same thing for $22,000. What would I do? What could I additionally, above and beyond, what could I do that's not in option one? So not more of option one, but how could I add value to what I listed in option one that would be potentially attractive to someone in this situation, still leverages my expertise? And you do the same thing at the $50,000 price point. So across these three options, you've got a big range of budgets. If you're remotely close on your value and the client takes you as a credible expert, like they trust you, and that's a whole different conversation, but they need to trust you and believe that it's credible. And you give them a fixed price. It won't be a penny more than this. And at each level, I commit to, or guarantee, or however you want to put it, I commit to delivering this particular contribution to this overall thing, right? So you can measure it as you're going along. It's like, look, I did the contribution. I did the piece that I said I would do, the page speed, you know, the page time is down to one, you know, sub 1 second, the traffic is maintained, you know, stays the same, whatever the thing is in your area of expertise, you commit to some benefits for each different option that are going to be worth something to the buyer, and they can make a real buying decision. And then if they say yes, then the pressure's on you to execute against that promise. So again, this is for people that know what they're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, this will wreck you.
Right,
because you just end up working forever. But if you're an expert and you're confident that your expertise will contribute to this desired outcome, and the client, this is important, the client believes it too, that's why they called you, and they're right, your agreement, everybody's happy, then you just get to work. They pay you 100% up front and you drop plow and do your thing and deliver the benefits.
So I have a bunch of follow-on questions. That was great. It's like, first of all, I just want to say, like, if you have a doctor do surgery on your knee, you don't pay the doctor X dollars an hour. right? Like that would be ridiculous. You're paying for a better knee that lets you go out and run again or whatever the situation might be. So I think that's really important for folks to understand who are thinking of, gosh, my effective hourly rate seems outrageous. Well, who cares? That's not what people are actually buying.
I want your time. Right.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, if we're going to give them a recurring $100,000 a year benefit, why do we have to cap out at 50% of the year one value?
I just find it's easy to get agreement at that. You know, in software anyway, it's pretty hard to predict really what's going to happen past certainly 2 years. You know, like all kinds of Amazon could come into your space. So many things can happen. But for a year, you know, like post-launch, a year post-launch, I'm sure it's a conservative estimate. It's like super conservative. So there's nothing to argue. No one's going to say, well, we don't know. It might not last in three. I might not even work here in 3 years. You know, I might sell the business, you know. So 3 years is kind of, it's just like too much of a time horizon for me. I think 1 year and it's likely to continue after that. But even if it doesn't, you made your money back in 6 months if they pick the highest option. You just make a really easy yes. But hysterically, 50 grand is probably 10 times more than you would have estimated, maybe double what you would have estimated for an hourly rate, and you would ended up at 50 anyway and not solved their problem because you didn't even find out what their problem was.
And I guess you can always go back in year two, year three, you delivered the value, they're happy with you, you like working with them, you can do the next project.
Yep. Yeah. And for a big project like this, it would usually be 2 or 3 years before they came back for something of that nature. But honestly, there's another thing we could talk about, advisory retainers. Another thing I learned from Alan, that if you don't like the idea of just doing these projects where, you know, you got to wait 3 years for them to maybe come back, then we could talk about a whole different business model, different, or at least a different product offering that would be more recurring revenue. But for a project, I think it's just really easy to get a yes if you just limit it to the first year, what it's worth in 1 year. And my close rate was insane when I was doing this. It was like 85% of people that I would write a proposal for were like, yes. And I was the most expensive person they were considering, if they were considering anyone else at all. It was, I would just get yeses all the time. It was the only time I didn't get a yes was when I was just completely out of the ballpark on the value, which was, you know, as I got better at it, it didn't happen that often.
So a couple of follow-on questions from that. You mentioned getting 100% up front. So let's talk about that. A lot of folks are nervous to ask for too much money up front, or sometimes any money up front. What are the keys to making sure that you get all of it up front? And is that always reasonable or sometimes?
It's not always reasonable. I start there. It's a starting point for me because it gives something, because it's shocking. And it gives you something to negotiate other than the price. So, but a surprising number of people would just say, yes, checks in the mail, when can you start? And like, wow, okay, it's a lot. Maybe 75, 80% of people just be like, yes, here, let's get started. Again, this is because of trust, which is a separate thing that we haven't talked about, but you know, my claim was credible. They believed that it was true and I was the right person for the job. So they just write the check and get it over with. Other times they'll come back and say, well, what about 50-50? We just met you, you know, let's just, I'd say fine. You know, they usually say 50 now and 50 when you're done. And I'd say, we could talk about that, but then that gets us into a sign-off situation. So that you would need to give me sign-off before I would send my last invoice. And once sign-off happens, anything I need to do after the project is over is going to be cost you more money. And in my experience, these things are never done when you think they're done. It takes a while for the paint to dry, for the lake to freeze over. At some point, you know it's safe, but you're not sure exactly when it happened. So I say, what I'd rather do is two payments is fine, but let's do the second payment on a date. And I'll just keep working until the goal is achieved. And we don't have to worry about when it is signing off too soon, because clients always sign off too soon. So, all right. They're like, oh, that's reasonable. When the second date? So I'd say, depending on the size of the project, I'd probably say, well, first 50% on day one and the other 50% in 3 months or 60 days or 30 days or whatever, you know, whatever you think the middle of the project might be. And if they, again, they're like, well, We're not really sure. And I'd say, look, I don't care when the second date is. Just pick a date that you think is reasonable when the project will be over, and that'll be the day. But then we can just forget about the money, and I'll just keep working until you guys are satisfied. And I've never had anybody go through that whole, for me personally, I've never had anybody go through all of that and still insist on sign off. It's never happened.
Got it.
So,
Okay. Now you also mentioned sort of commitments or guarantees. What are you able to commit to? Because obviously for the buyer, it's great to have some kind of guarantee or commitment. When at the same time, a lot of what you're doing may depend on them delivering stuff to you as well.
So part of the issue with a fixed price, whether it's value based or some other way, is that the client recognizes right away that now it's in your best interest to finish fast. That's good for them. They want that to be in your best interest, but it also raises the specter of cutting corners. Is this person going to cut corners to finish fast and have a better effective hourly rate, right? And then it becomes a fight about bugs or whatever quality. So I like to include a guarantee so that it as an answer for that question. So they'll be like, oh, well, he can't cut corners if there's a 12-month bug-free guarantee, or whatever your guarantee might be. The idea of guaranteeing anything, I know from talking to hundreds of people, it terrifies them. And I would ask people to sit with that terror and ask themselves, if you're such an expert, why are you so terrified of guaranteeing your work? Like, why don't you stand behind your work? Like, think about that. And when they think about it, they usually find that they do stand behind their work and implicitly guarantee things all the time. So things that they feel fall below their professional standards, that they would be embarrassed if there was like a bug in production, or they'd be embarrassed if the bridge fell down, or something that would be totally embarrassing to them, that they'd feel like they should give the money back. What are the things that you already implicitly guarantee and turn them explicit in the proposal? So what are the things that you have probably done in the past? Like maybe in the past you delivered some software and maybe you had a contractor do some of it for you and it stunk and you didn't know about it till later, or there was some report that they only run quarterly that absolutely blew up and they didn't test it. They should have, but they didn't. They didn't find the bug. And your listeners probably have had the experience of just going back and fixing it because they were embarrassed because it was their fault. So just say that in the proposal, right? Is you're not taking any additional risk. It's what you would have done anyway, but you're saying up front, it depends on what you do. If I act unprofessionally, I will make it right in some way. If I don't return your calls within 48 hours, I will make it right in some way. If there's some major bug in production, I will make it right in some way. If I delete your production database, I will make it right in some way. It could be a money back thing. It could be a free work type of thing. It could be retaking a workshop, the free retakes. The guarantees are different for every different service. But for software, the one that seems most comfortable to people, most natural to them, is some duration after the launch of like a car warranty. Like if anything breaks, we'll fix it for free, right? And it's the kind of thing they probably have done previously. And I don't, and I say to my coaching students, I'm like, don't even get into like whether or not it was your fault or their fault or it was a bug or whatever, just fix it. But knowing that you're going to do that, set your price appropriately. Like that scope needs to fit inside of the budget. So maybe you'll only offer that on option three, the one that's $500,000, the $500,000 option for this $1 million value. I will stay engaged for 6 months post launch, and if anything breaks, I will fix it for free. Doesn't matter if it was their IT guy upgraded Ubuntu and it broke something in Europe, whatever, doesn't matter. Just fix it. And they don't want to be calling you for, they don't want things breaking, and they're not going to break things on purpose just to get more work out of you. They want things to run smoothly. They don't feel like bothering you with things like that. They're only going to call you if things are on fire. So thing catches on fire, you come in, you fix it. It takes you 2 seconds probably, or a couple of hours, whatever, because the code base. You did a good job. It was high quality code because you knew you were on the hook to fix it if it broke. So there's comments everywhere and all that. So or documentation. You created videos to remind yourself how this complicated business logic worked. So you can create all of these tools to make one of these guarantees almost free money, you know. And it takes away, it answers the question, well, how do we know you're not going to cut corners? Well, because I'm on the hook for 12 months afterwards if anything breaks. It's like,
And I think
sheesh,
that's a great
okay.
point because it also aligns you with doing your best work, right? Like really doing it right, documenting, making videos, whether it's for you and or for the client or the person who's going to take over your code or your project or whatever it is. And sort of the gut rule I like to use when I'm pricing something is when they call me about something that may or may not be my fault, that is going to involve effort and consternation from me. Am I happy they called because I get to like really make sure they're successful, or am I irritated because I'm feel right? And so it's up to me to price things appropriately so that when the phone rings, I'm like, hey, Jonathan, hey, I'm so glad you called. Oh, that's really interesting. Let's take care of that right away. And I feel good because I'm like a professional, not some contractor getting abused.
And you have enough margin that you can be a professional. You can act like a professional because you're not scrambling for the next client. You're not booked 40 to 50 hours a week trying to get your billable hours in. You're like doing marketing, you're writing a book, you're doing other stuff that is working on your business to build your business, and then the phone rings and they're like, "Oh, something broke." You're like, "No problem. I'm on it.
Yeah, I care about
I'll let
you.
you know." Right. Yeah, I can't I'm like friends. Some of my best friends are past clients. Right? They are under my care. You know, it doesn't mean I'm going to do absolutely everything for them. It doesn't mean I'm not going to say no
Right.
to certain things if I especially if I think it'll jeopardize the project. And I tell them that up front. If you ask me to do something that doesn't contribute to the goal of this project, I'm going to say no. So if that's not okay, you just tell me now and we don't have to work together. But if you want me to protect you from the shiny object syndrome that you just told me you have,
Right.
I'm your guy.
And
But
you
be
said something
prepared.
at the
Yeah, go ahead.
beginning that I think is really important. When you have this value-based relationship as opposed to the hourly relationship, it is so much better, right? It's like imagine you're going over the surgeon's hourly activities line by line, frustrated, instead of can you just make sure my knee is fixed? It's absurd.
I love the doctor analogy, and I recommend to people all the time to act like a doctor in the sales interview. So like the client is basically running in and saying, "Doc, I need a triple bypass. Can you do a triple bypass?" Doctor doesn't say, "Sure, jump up on the table. I'll go get my scalpel." There's hold your horses, buddy. You might just need an antacid. You might just need to change your diet. It might be something completely different. You might be right. Maybe you do need it, right? But let's pump the brakes for a second. And and that's when you find to use the knee example, you'd say the doctor would ask something like, "Well, how are you planning on using it? Are you a long distance runner? Are you a professional athlete? Are you just happy to be able to take your dog for a walk? Like, how good does it need to be? How good did it used to be before this happened? How good does it need to be?" And it might be that you're Usain Bolt. And the doctor says, "Look, you should go to a specialist. Like, I can do knees, but you're like a world-class sprinter. Maybe you should go to this other person who Usain Bolt probably already knows of anyway." But you know what I'm saying? Right? It's not just like, it's not, you want to know what their desired future state is. You want to know if you are confident, you want to be confident that you can satisfy them. So if someone said, "Oh, I'm 50 pounds overweight and I blew my knee out getting out of the recliner, and I want you to fix my knee so I can run like Usain Bolt," I don't think so.
You run like Usain Bolt out of the room.
Yeah, exactly. I hope I'm saying his name right. But yeah, so anyway, just I love the doctor analogy because doctors will never just tell you to jump up on the table and take your shirt off and just do a triple bypass on you. So take that approach. And doctors also never talk, the whole medical thing, the metaphor gets a little weird because of the way insurance works in the United
Right.
States, so it's a tough metaphor. But people, I think most people do have the experience of that diagnostic approach to doctors. They ask you these really open-ended questions. They'll ask the same question different ways. They're very slow and deliberate. And that's the way you want to be in one of these sales interviews. And that's how you get sort of inside and help the get inside, get empathetic with the customer. Potential customer and uncover what their desired future state is. I just want to be able to, play football with my kids. That's good enough. And I say, I am positive that this surgery, doctors will never give 100%, but they'll say, yeah, I'm confident that you will be able to do that based on what I've seen, based on what I've done in the past. I'm confident that I will be able to have you playing football with your kids. Yeah. And that playing football with the kids is the thing you price.
So I also want to revisit something you said at the very beginning, because I think it's really important. I just want to call attention to it just in case you missed it. Because I think there's a tendency amongst people when they do that interview, they either try to follow too much of a checklist, which doesn't let the prospect just unburden themselves and tell you what's really going on, or they just let them unburden themselves and don't apply any structure. So I really like what you said about you let them just get everything off their chest, and then you start with the more structured questions to make sure you have all the information you need for the diagnosis. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. I really like that.
You have to let them brain dump. They will not engage with you until the brain dump is done because they're very excited. Like they're finally pulling the trigger. They finally decided to start interviewing experts to help them with this thing. It's probably a big deal for them. Again, we're talking about projects here, non-trivial projects. So this is probably a reasonably risky thing that they're in their minds that feels risky, and they're going to have researched it. They're going to have nerves. They're going to think they know more than they do. And they think they're helping you. Like they think this is the best way to do it. They will not engage with these questions if they haven't puked out all of the information that it shouldn't take more than if it was taken, if we were like coming up on a half an hour and they were still going in circles, then I'd probably start to put an end to it. But they usually exhaust themselves after about 15, 20 minutes.
That's a great tip. And here's a shameless self-promotion for me, right? Within the Mimran CRM, if you're doing a proposal, you can put those three options right in the same proposal and let the client pick the one they want. So I'm just going to throw that out there. Jonathan, if people want to find out more about you or get your help directly, where can they find you?
Sure. So the best place to go if you're interested in value pricing specifically, which is just one of the things I teach to ditch hourly. My big thing is ditching hourly. Value pricing is one of the ways to do that. Go to valuepricingbootcamp.com and that will redirect you to a page on my website that has a 6-day free email course that goes into these issues in more detail. And it comes straight from my personal email. So you can reply to any message, ask me a question, tell me you love it, tell me you hate it, whatever you like. And yeah, we'll just go from there.
And maybe I'm just like a total pricing nerd, but I actually really like Jonathan's emails, and I think you will too. So, everyone's got a ton of crap in their inbox these days, and putting more stuff in it doesn't seem very appealing. I'm telling you right now, if you're listening to this and you're enjoying what Jonathan has to say, he's a not just a great speaker, he's also a great writer. So go do that, and we'll have links in the show notes.
Oh, thanks.
Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me. Cheers.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, there's something that resonated with you, would love to hear about it. Drop an iTunes review or a review wherever you listen to this podcast. If you've got a friend who would benefit from this episode, let them know about it. If you've got a friend who wouldn't benefit from this episode, but you just haven't talked to for a while, now's a great time to give them a call. Thanks for listening. Until next time.